Gamma Mash for the Chico Vibe. We're here with AC Thompson from ProPublica and Leslie Layton from Chico Soul. So welcome to KCFR, both of you fine people.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
Where are you located right now? Where are you sitting right now, AC?
I'm in Berkeley, California. I live in a small town called El Sobrante, California, not far from here.
AC, thanks for making time for the interview. Tell us about the database, why it was established, and what ProPublica would like to accomplish.
You know, so what became clear to myself and to the other people on our team back in November of last year was that the FBI stats on hate crimes are abysmal, that they are absolutely a massive undercount, that they don't capture the true scope and scale of hate crimes in America, and that the Bureau itself and other people at the Department of Justice admit as much. So about 20% of the law enforcement agencies in the country do not submit hate crime data to the FBI. And of the agencies, the law enforcement agencies that nominally participate in tracking hate crimes, about 80% of them say, hey, hate crimes never happen in our jurisdiction. So I would call those, you know, not particularly diligent efforts at tracking hate crimes. Our feeling was, wow, there's this massive data gap out there, and is there a way that we can help to fill it? And so what we set out to do was to work with a coalition of news organizations and civil rights groups, many of them serving different ethnic and religious communities, and say, hey, if people in your network, if your readers, if your listeners and viewers feel that they've been subjected to a hate crime, have them report it on this form, and we will channel it all into a single database and help sort of augment the federal data. You know, we're not looking to supplant it. We're not looking to be final. We're not looking to be the perfect data set. But what we're looking to do is add another layer of understanding to what's out there.
But the database also includes bias incidents, correct? And can you tell us what those are?
Yeah, that's a great point. So, you know, another thing that we wanted to do, rather than just collect things that are going to be categorized as hate crimes under federal law or under state law, is to collect incidents of bigotry, intolerance, hatred, bias that don't rise to the level of being a criminal offense. Because, you know, this is really the vast bulk of what happens, is people behaving badly to one another, but not necessarily breaking criminal law. So we're asking people, you know, if you've been targeted by someone who disparaged your ethnicity verbally at the store, if you've been the victim of online harassment, et cetera, please report these kind of incidents to us. So an example would go like this. I interviewed a Mexican-American gentleman who lives in Pennsylvania the other day, and his story was about going to the Costco in his town and a white gentleman coming up to him and saying, hey, I'm a member of a militia. I was just down on the border. We're going to get rid of all you people. All you Mexicans are going to go back to your country. You better look out. And, of course, the guy who was getting harassed is an American citizen, so who happens to be ethnically Mexican-American. And those are the kind of incidents. You know, this is not a crime, but it's obviously harassment. It's obviously disturbing, and it's the kind of thing that's not really being tracked right now.
Would you call this hate speech? Is that a good phrase to use? And I'm interested because somebody I interviewed this past week just said to me, what is hate speech and how would you define it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really murky area, right? Like, hate speech is a poorly defined category that's sort of very subjective, right? I would use a different terminology, and I would say that it's an incident of harassment, it's an incident of bigotry, it's an incident of bias against somebody's ethnicity and perhaps national origin. The hate speech thing, I feel like, is a label that gets thrown out, and it means a lot of different things to different people. So it's not one that I find particularly useful, honestly.
Interesting. So as I've started to talk to people around here about the database, a lot of people look at me sort of quizzically and say, there's an incident of bigotry every day in Chico. Are we really going to submit a report to your national database and, you know, say, oh, Chico again? What is the purpose of doing this?
We definitely want those kind of incidents that are not absolutely atrocious, that are nasty, but they're not the most horrible things out there. They've become routine. We want those because we're bearing witness to a moment in history in which this sort of bigotry absolutely seems to be on the rise, and it seems to have become ubiquitous. And so part of it is documenting that ubiquity, that sense that we are becoming inured to this kind of bias and bigotry and hatred. So yeah, we do want that stuff. You know, one really key thing with the database is, you know, there's around 3,000 incidents in it, and the reporters that are part of our network are mining that database for patterns, for trends, for phenomenon that may go otherwise unnoticed. And so, you know, a big thing about this is that it is a tip sheet for journalists to understand better what's going on at this moment. And I think we've been pretty effective in using it that way, you know, from uncovering a pattern of Indian Americans, immigrants from India, being harassed, abused, threatened, to, you know, this exactly what you were talking about, this sort of verbal meme of telling people to go back to your own country, which a couple of our outlets have done stories about. You know, what we're looking for is sort of the narrative that is behind the statistics.
And should the database be used for statistics?
No.
So it's really to look for patterns, for trends. But tell us a little bit about the vetting and what are the limitations of the database?
Yeah, so the organizations that are part of our network, the news organizations and civil rights groups, they can all look into the database and check out these different incidents that have been reported by the different partners in the project. And so, for example, anything that comes in through ProPublica, I can immediately look at and pull up all the detail on and contact the people who contacted us. I can also look and I can see what was reported to the New York Times or to BuzzFeed or to Univision and get most of the information there. And if I'm interested in further pursuing the tips that have come into them, the reports that have come into them, I just contact them and say, hey, you know, I'm interested in looking into this allegation. Can you share the contact info with me of the person that made this allegation? And when we get the contact information of these people, either through our partners or through my organization, what we do is we contact them, we call them up, we ask for any kind of documentary proof that they have, that they filed a police report, that they took photos, that they posted on social media right after it happened, a video, you know, that sort of thing. And so what we're really trying to do is vet these incidents to and report on them, just like any kind of reporting, to assure that these are genuine incidents, and as far as we can tell, that these are authentic reports of bias, abuse, and hate crimes.
And there's a certain level of confidentiality when you submit the form. So that contact data is only available to those of us who are partners, correct?
Yeah, exactly. And so the contact data, like I said, that comes into ProPublica, that lives with us and that stays with us. And we can share it with other members of the project, but it stays within the project. And, you know, the other partners on this effort have to contact us and ask us, hey, can you share that information with us? And then if the information is shared, it is flagged in the system, hey, so-and-so is reaching out to this alleged victim. That will be the point of contact for the victim so that they are not getting deluged with calls from media organizations around the country and getting re-traumatized and feeling maybe like, this is more than I wanted to deal with, but that there's one reporter reaching out to them, not a swarm of them.
And was the database established right after the election on the premise that people were feeling empowered to be more openly hateful? Do we know for sure that there's been an uptick in incidents, or is that a theory?
Well, you know, part of it was this, is that I'm a student of the far right. It's a subject that I've been fascinated and disgusted by for a very long time. And so over the last year of the election campaign, I was watching more and more signs that there was a reinvigorated racist right and that there was more activity from the white supremacist and supposed white nationalist sector than there had been in years and years. And so I already knew that something was afoot that was unusual in American life and that this was a phenomenon that was happening. Meanwhile, late in the election campaign and in the days after the election, there seemed to be a lot of reports of racist graffiti, racist harassment, and racist crime that was linked to the election. So this is graffiti that says, "Make America White Again," playing off the Trump campaign slogan. Or this is graffiti that says Trump with a big swastika where the M should be. Or this is, you know, verbally yelling in school at kids with brown skin, build the wall, get out of my country. You know, that sort of stuff that really, in terms of a narrative, seemed to be connected to the themes that were big during the election. So we thought it was important to look at that. It is impossible to say absolutely conclusively that there has been a uptick in hate crimes since the election, because the FBI data, as flawed as it is not yet available. And the 2016 data will be available in late 2017. And so even that will only capture a part of this phenomenon. What I can say is the data that's collected at a local level, if you look at the cities that will now produce hate crime stats for what's going on in their cities, 2016, early 2017, you will see what seems to be a significant surge in hate crimes in many cities across the country during 2016 and so far in 2017. It's not conclusive, it's not the whole country, but the early reports seem to indicate that there is an increase.
Well, that's interesting. And I read an article recently, you may have seen it in Salon, from the Center, an interview with the Center for Hate, Study of Hate and Extremism at San Bernardino. Did you see that article?
No, and but I talked to Brian Levin a lot, the guy that runs it.
They were reporting that California, actually, the hate crimes were increasing faster than in the country as a whole, and that in 2015 there was this huge spike that was actually bigger than the national average, which is surprising. Is that your impression, that California is really sort of at the forefront of this far-right movement?
Yeah, yes and no. I mean, I think there's an important distinction to make, right? And the distinction is between sort of the casual racists who are not part of an organized hate crimes movement or an organized hateful movement, right? And then you have the organized extreme right racists. I would say that the organized far right racist movements have become an incredibly diffuse scene. That, you know, in earlier days, these were movements that were built around small cells of people, whether it was Klan groups, whether these were skinhead groups, whether these were Aryan Nations groups, that actually were people who met in person and hung out and got guns and handled their business in their racist fashion. What I think you see now is a much, much more diffuse, networked movement that really is propelled by the internet. And I think, like, sort of tracking the geography of that has become very, very difficult because of that. When you look at those 2015 hate crimes numbers on California, they're definitely concerning. They're definitely worrisome. I think one of the things that you may see in California is it may be partially a reporting effect, though. Mm. And that is that California has mandated hate crimes training for all police recruits when they go through the academy. California has very good reporting by local police departments up to the state attorney general And then that information is then forwarded on to the FBI. And California does a really good job of tracking these cases all the way through the process. So from the time that there's a report of a hate crime to the time the case is adjudicated. And partially what you may be seeing is a better reporting, better documentation.
So you mentioned that we have sort of like casual racists and then an organized movement. And one thing I'm interested in is, how does publicity about what they're doing affect them? And does reporting to the database, and then when people see stories come out, does it feed them and sort of they think, wow, I got some publicity for that, great? Or do they feel embarrassed?
My thinking on this is that there is often an unintended consequence of reporting on, I think particularly reporting on organized hate groups and the activities of organized hate groups. I think to a certain extent, the media amplifies their message by reporting on it. And I think that's somewhat unavoidable. And I think it's an unwelcome, unintended consequence of just doing the reporting. If you report on Richard Spencer's activities, or if you report on the activities of the Daily Stormer, the fascist website out of Ohio, you are giving them publicity and spreading their name around, and they may find a larger audience because of it. There was a group called Adam Waffen that's a young neo-Nazi group, mostly younger 20-something types, and you know, one of their tactics was to put up offensive posters at college campuses, wait for the media and the students and the faculty to get upset, disturbed, enraged, and to then ride that wave of media outrage and publicity to find a larger audience. And they would get a larger audience than just, you know, the flyers they put up on campus that would only be seen by people on campus. Now they're reaching tens of thousands or millions of people. And so that's absolutely a tactic that they were using. At the same time, I think if people put up neo-Nazi flyers at your school or in your town, it's hard as a person of conscience and as a journalist to ignore that. You know, it's hard to figure out how to straddle that line of not encouraging these people and at the same time saying, like, hey, this is going on where we live, where we work, where we go to school, and it's something that folks should be aware of.
So it doesn't do anything to discourage the casual racist. They don't.
You know, with the casual racist, this is like a phenomenon that I see. This is a pattern that I see, is people do nasty things. They do awful things. They end up getting kicked out of school. They end up getting disciplined. They end up getting criminally prosecuted. And when there are those consequences, they often say, like, oh, you know, what I did was messed up, and I feel embarrassed, and I feel stupid, and I feel like, you know, I need to be a better human being. And I think that that process sometimes does have, you know, the sort of those consequences sometimes do have a sort of transformative effect on the perpetrators when people are allowed to do these sorts of incidents and remain anonymous, then they just tend to keep doing them, you know. But it can also go the other way. You know, there was one of the real prominent neo-Nazi hackers, a guy who goes by the name Weave, who is deeply involved in the neo-Nazi movement. You know, he's a guy who went to prison and decided that it was the Jews and people of color that were ruining his life, and that hardened his resolve, you know, and made him more of a racist. And so it can go both ways, but I hear a lot of stories about people being convicted of hate crimes and saying, hey, you know, I want to reach out to the people that I've victimized and sort of, you know, find some understanding and apologize and actually do community service in that community to try to make up for it. So I think it's a mixed bag.
And there's one thing we haven't talked about that we really need to, and that's, you know, how to access this database, how to follow your project on Facebook and Twitter. So maybe if you could land on that for a little bit and some closing comments.
Yeah, so the main hub for the project is at documentinghate.com, and that will take you to all the stories that are put out by the partners, all the information about the partners, et cetera, et cetera. We are also on Twitter at DocumentHate is the handle. You can follow the ProPublica Facebook page, has information on it as well. And we've got a ton of partners. The whole list of partners is there on the website, and we're really excited to have a massive, massive collection of good journalists working on this.
And I just want to add that the first report from Chico to be entered in your database was about a defaced flyer on Chico State University campus right after the election, where someone had crossed out "Your Vote Matters" and said "Trump matters, MAGA," and then use some white supremacy language, 1488, I guess. So, you know, that was something when I was contacted about it, I followed up on, and it turned out to be really interesting. The woman who had put up the flyer about that saying "Your vote matters" was devastated about what had happened to it, and there hadn't been really any public discussion about that, you know, that defacing, and so I think that this is a really good thing in terms of not normalizing this stuff. But I just want to encourage members of the public that if you've experienced a hate incident or you think you've been a witness to a hate crime, there is a form available on chicosoul.org that you can fill out. It will be submitted online to the ProPublica database, and your name will be confidential to the extent that it won't become public unless you give your permission. Is that a pretty good assessment of how it works?
Yeah. Okay. And that's both disturbing that incidents are coming in Chico and exciting that people are taking advantage of the platform and the desire to report.
I appreciate your time today helping us explain why the database can play an important role and what it's for. So thank you.
Well, hey, thanks for having me on. I'm happy to do it.